Coming up next on 94.7 WTVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Everyone, welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville and Resistance Radio. I like to say Persistence Radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're speaking with Lisa Spiedel, assistant professor in the Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality at the University of Virginia. She's worked in Charlottesville for 24 years, focusing on gender-based violence at the intersection of racism and other forms of systemic oppression. We'll talk about what defines healthy masculinity and healthy sexuality, and we'll hear about her self-defense program that focuses on acquaintance assault and much more, I am sure. And we welcome back to the program Kale Jaffe, Director of the Environmental and Regulatory Law Clinic at the University of Virginia School of Law. We're going to talk about a current Virginia case that could overturn a ban on uranium mining that has existed in this state since 1982 and the resulting health and environmental impacts that would occur if mining was allowed, and we'll examine the far-reaching implications for the rest of the country. So in just a year and a half, we have spoken to over 100 fascinating, talented, scholarly guests like these on this program about everything from the rise of fascism to the life of bees, from Black Twitter to the refugee crisis, from soul food to how to make a balanced cocktail, and so much more. Check out all our podcasts. You can download them at 947wpvc.org. And finally, Nancy, are you there?
In the parlance of a former campaign manager, I plead guilty to being here. Yes, I am here.
And that is one that is among many guilty pleas I'm very happy to hear about. Did you ever think Manafort would plead guilty and be talking to Mueller?
No, it's such a witch hunt. I can't believe it. Yeah, actually, I am shocked that he did. I totally thought he was going to keep his mouth shut for fear that the Russians would harm him and his family. I guess he feel safer, like, you know, with the federal government, but I just didn't think he would do it. No,
I totally was worried, or I'm still worried actually, about like a nerve agent somehow getting into that jail cell.
So
what I'm hoping is that he already has talked a lot to Mueller, which he must have, because otherwise
get it out now. I know. I've got every action movie, you know, every Ocean's 8, 9, 10, whatever. They're all, you know, how they're going to sneak in there and slip in some polonium. I know. I'm with you.
I know.
I'm worried about it.
So what do you think he's got? What do you think the big, big blockbuster is? Is it about Trump himself, about Russians, about all of it?
I hope there is some irrefutable, is that the word, evidence that connects Trump to all of this. I am so, I feel like that's the only way that he will go away, honestly, if it's lock solid. But I'll take anything. I'm not truly not that picky. Anything that he's got that can seal the case on whoever's out there, I'm in favor of.
It's not Halloween yet, but it's sounding like Halloween here. But yes, I will take anything. Let the truth come out, because you know he's just been up to no good.
If anyone's going to do an A-plus job, please let it be Paul Manafort. I think that's my feeling, yeah.
Yeah. So just one of there were like 18 pages detailing the crimes, I guess, a hearing.
Right?
And like, so he admitted to guilt in conspiring against the United States and conspiring to obstruct justice. But then there was, which I guess a lot of this stuff had already come out. You can tell me if you've heard it before, but he admitted to spreading the false stories in the U.S., smearing Hillary Clinton, that she was anti-Semitic, all the stuff about, you know, propping up the Ukrainian president, blah, 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 that eventually, that was, you know, while she was Secretary of State. And then eventually it just continued, you know, the group he had manifesting this these false stories just continued into the 2016 election.
Very busy man. I know. Can you imagine his LinkedIn resume? I mean, what? I can't believe
I hope he's LinkedIn.
He has been doing.
I hope he's LinkedIn for a very long time in the jail cell.
And you know he's not the only one. I mean, he obviously needed that $13 million income every year that he put himself out there, exposed himself to this campaign. And who knows if he could have continued to do this, you know, without getting nailed to the wall if he hadn't taken on this job, which obviously he felt he needed to get all that money back, the money he owed. It's just, you know.
So much to talk about, but I feel compelled to move on to talk about our guests.
That new apartment we have in Trump Tower that Manafort gave us yesterday.
Yes. Yeah.
No, I'm sorry.
No, Seaville Pride is today at the Pavilion here in Charlottesville, and I will be representing our show, Apropos of Something. So stop by at the Pavilion. I'm going to be wearing our new T-shirt. It's orange and heather gray. And then I'll be sharing a table with one of our former guests, Priya Mahadevan of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense. And she's got a bunch of women there who will be wearing a lot of red shirts. So that's where I'll be. And then also the Seaville Sabroso was supposed to be today or tomorrow, but it is going to be October 7th. That's the annual Latin American Cultural Arts Festival.
You guys are very lucky that Florence did not hit land at your place.
Oh, man. Tell me about it. I have sandbags. I finally got my emergency kit together. I'm very happy about. But yeah, we are very, 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 very relieved here. Hope that everyone else is safe in the country.
I know. It's going to be a nightmare for a while.
So speaking of the opposite of nightmares, we have an excellent show today.
Yes.
Our first guest is Lisa Spiedel. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality at UVA. She has worked in the Charlottesville community for 24 years in multiple positions related to women, gender, and sexuality studies. Her outreach services at the Sexual Assault Resource Agency called SARA. It includes training programs at UVA and working directly with sexual assault peer education groups at the university. Her work focuses on examining the role of masculinity, healthy sexuality, gender-based violence, and racism and other forms of systemic oppression. She also teaches women's self-defense classes, both in the community and as a credit-based class at UVA. And she's developed a new self-defense program that focuses on acquaintance assault. She's currently working on an anthology that encompasses the unheard voices of navigating a sexually confusing culture. Well, welcome to the show, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
That is quite a lot of work you have, a large body of work there. Can you tell us what is going on in our culture and on campuses with, you know, so much of the prevalent sexual assault? And does it relate to the notion of what is healthy masculinity? I'll let you take that.
Yeah, it's very related to the healthy masculinity. I think that we have a tendency to want to address sexual assault issues and focus on the potential victims and say, you know, this is what you should be doing to stay safe. And we often aren't focusing on cultural change that needs to happen. I'm lucky because I get to teach metamasculinities and human sexualities and teach self-defense, and for me, all of those are related. Healthy masculinity is a concept that is masculinity studies in itself is newer as a concept within sort of the academic realm, so it's been pretty exciting to get students to think about what role masculinity may play in violence. We have a tendency to be gender neutral about violence when we know that the majority of violence that's perpetrated is by men. Although most men are not violent, most perpetrators are men. We often don't have that conversation. So it's been exciting to focus on how do we promote healthy masculinity and what role does it play?
How do you incorporate that notion itself in the training programs that you offer at UVA, the sexual assault programs?
When I teach self-defense, you mean?
Yes.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. So that's definitely part of the conversation. My class focuses on women as the students that are learning the techniques, but it's important for a gender analysis to be part of that conversation, both for the women and what pressures and expectations they feel, but also what role masculinity can play in the context of violence.
Can you explain that a little bit? And
sure.
Maybe take us down that path to examine that.
Okay, yes. Yeah. There's a lot of pressures and expectations, what we call the man box. That's an exercise that we do in class. So what are the stereotypical expectations of what it means to be masculine? And then what are men called if they don't perfectly fit in that box? A lot of that language is very anti-femininity. It's homophobic. And it's violence can often be used as a way to get back inside the box. It may be trying to prove that, you know, you actually are inside the box. It can be taking it out on someone else. It can be bullying. It can be domestic violence. It can be sexual violence. It doesn't mean that alone is going to make somebody violent, but it's a contributing factor. Mm-hmm. And so we often use language, like I said before, we'll say, like, say if there's school shootings, we say the shooter, or youth violence. We often don't have a gendered analysis of that. We make it very neutral when, again, most of that's being inflicted by boys and men. And my approach to this conversation isn't to say that men are bad in any way, but what are these pressures and expectations that may be contributing factors to that?
Yeah. Can you go further into that? So what is the gender analysis that you would do with your students and what you can tell us?
Well, we would, there's a lot of the gender policing as part of that conversation that we have. So why do we care, you know, what drink a man is drinking, like what color the drink is? And we all are participating in the gender policing, and feeling like men are supposed to perfectly fit in this box. And if they're feeling other pressures and expectations around not showing emotions, I mean, if you really start to repress your own emotions, it can be really difficult to feel empathy for others if you don't feel for yourself. And a lack of empathy can be a contributing factor to violence. There's oftentimes the idea that men should be very sexual or sleep around a lot. You can often have sex and violence overlapping, you know, depending on what someone's upbringing is. Again, these aren't absolutely things that are going to make men violent, but could be contributing factors. And so that's part of what we break down.
I just want to follow up with that and say that I think Niobe Wade, do you know her work? She has spoken about the way boys are, you know, how they're, I guess, acculturated, the right word, how they're brought into society, that they have very close relationships when they're young and they share their emotions. And then at a certain point, it is not cool to do that, maybe throw an arm over someone unless it's in sports. And then they are, you know, victimized, so to speak. They're called, you know, gay or fags or whatever it is. And then that goes away. And so then they don't express their emotions. And then some of the things that you're talking about happens. I find that very interesting. Have you found that as well?
Yeah. And it's you know, how it's estimated around 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused before the age of 18. And the rate in which boys are experiencing violence is high. And as trauma survivors, we're not creating spaces for boys and men to process that, to feel it. I mean, we have little boys. You have a little boy running down the street who scrapes his knees. You know, what do we do in response to that versus the little girl who runs down the street and scrapes her knees? You know, it's a human response to feel. And we're socializing that out of boys in particular. And we say things like man up and, you know, and buck up or don't throw like a girl and, you know, all these messages that
be a man.
Yeah, be a man. And, you know, there are lots of ways to be a man and be a great person at the same time. And that's one of my favorite things about teaching is just all the men that I get to work with, and they care about this. They really want to be good people, and they are good people, and they feel these pressures and expectations. And we often don't give men permission to have that conversation. It's not masculine to talk about masculinity. It's like, oh, you're being too soft if you're feeling, you know, about something. But they feel, they're complex human beings, right? Mm-hmm. So it's what are we unknowingly doing when we think that that's protecting boys. You know, it's like, oh, some of my students will say if they're not tough enough, they're going to be victimized. But you could fit perfectly in the box and still be targeted for bullying. Like, what about other skills building that we could do with boys? Like how to respond to different bullying actions.
I was curious, Lisa, just at the start of your self-defense classes, what you hear from women about their bodies and how, I'm sure it does change since you've been doing this for such a long time, how, the change that they have in their own bodies from the start of your self-defense classes to the completion.
It's pretty amazing to watch. I mean, I think that's where I'm very enthusiastically continuing to teach this class, particularly the one at UVA is about 35 hours long. So the transition is beautiful to watch. There's some women that come in that have already been playing sports or have done some martial arts. So there's some level of comfort. I'd say the majority haven't used their bodies physically in that way. So the confidence, the empowerment that happens, just feeling like their body can do amazing things. We as girls have been socialized to think that we're weaker, that we're not able to use our bodies in a way to protect ourselves, that we're supposed to rely on a dog or a man or somebody else to protect us. So it's pretty empowering to see that feeling of independence and claiming of their own bodies and knowing that they have a lot of things they can do with their bodies.
Do you, do you ever find that there are the women there? Is it fair to say the women are there because they want to be, or are they, do they fight you on losing their femininity, or do you have pushback from that, or is everyone usually in the same place, at least at the start?
People choose to take the class, so I think I think the motivation. I mean, I do ask at the beginning of class, what's something that's moved you to be here today? And for a lot of folks, we get emails of reports, of assaults that are happening, and there's a lot of fear, particularly as college students. And so I think that's often the motivation. And then it's a pleasant surprise what they're realizing they can actually do with their bodies in the process. It's sort of a side benefit. And I try to let folks know that this isn't about changing your way in which you perform femininity. It's just adding to who you already are.
This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more from Lisa Spiedel. We're talking about gender-based violence, healthy masculinity, and healthy sexuality. And after that, we're going to talk with Cale Jaffe. He is the director of the Environmental and Regulatory Law Clinic at the University of Virginia School of Law. We will be right back. Welcome back, everybody. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And you're listening to Apropos of Something. We are talking with Lisa Spiedel right now. Lisa, I wanted to ask you about the self-defense program that you started.
Yeah. So a couple years ago, I've been teaching with Brian O'Donnell with the Charlottesville Police Department for a while. We jointly teach different courses, and we, along with Gordon Emery with the Seaville Jiu-Jitsu School, have created a new curriculum that we call Real Self-Defense for Women, which is resistance, empowerment, awareness, and life skills, is the R-E-A-L. And what we were noticing, that there's a lot of really great national curriculums, international curriculums. The focus is very much on street combat and stranger assault, which is how we've often been socialized, is to fear those things. And a lot of the, quote, prevention techniques that girls are taught historically and present day still focus very much on stranger assault. I could ask any class, what do you do to stay safe? And everything will be about strangers, locking doors, carrying mace, all of these things. And really, the more I've been teaching the class and the more I've been working with survivors and my work at the Sexual Assault Resource Agency, we know statistically it's around 85% to 90% of assaults are being done by somebody that's known to you. And so we've been gathering stories and reports of what are the most common kinds of assaults that happen. And those are things that are happening, in a sexual context already, that somebody may be consenting to some acts, but then that's not being respected after a certain act has, they're trying to move on to another act. It could be in a bed, it could be on the floor, and a very common space is assault on a couch. So we've created couch defense techniques that are really fun to teach. We bring in couches and practice on couches, and people learn how to get out of different grabs and holds. So it's been really exciting to create this curriculum. So we've been teaching it for a couple of years, and Gordon and Brian are amazing people. I want to be them when I grow up.
And that's that falls under acquaintance assault, correct?
Yes.
So that we can put it somewhere in.
Yeah. So acquaintance assault as a umbrella term really means anybody you know. So it could be somebody you've been involved with in a relationship. It could be a coworker, a family member. So it's interesting that we've been so focused on stranger assault for so long when that's such a small percentage. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean whatever you're choosing to do to stay safe is wrong, or that, if that feels good. But if that one thing, if you're only relying on one thing and that doesn't work, what's the next step you're going to take? So really, the historically, what we've been taught is what's called a victim control model, which basically means the potential victim needs to change their behavior in order to not be assaulted. If we really had that much power and control over somebody else, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So the focus of this curriculum is what's called an empowerment education model, so that you have as many tools available to you as possible for lots of different situations.
Just to follow up, so Charlottesville is such a university town. Are you finding the same thing within grounds here or campus here, that it's usually an acquaintance?
Yes.
Or is it different? Okay.
Yes. Typically, though, those are not always reported. I mean, it's pretty underreported crime in general. It's estimated only about 20% are being reported. So that can often not be what we hear about. Like when we get the emails reporting, it's usually we don't know who the perpetrator is. This person's at large. And so we get those emails.
That's exactly what I was thinking about.
So it's a hard, can be a difficult process to report. It can be a hard crime to prosecute in general and collect evidence. And so it's
underreported. Yeah.
And we really notice the students who are learning the curriculum just feel like, wow, this is, I've been here. Like, I feel like I've been in a situation on a couch, and we're trying to normalize what the reality is as far as what spaces you might be in versus this stereotype of the boogeyman jumping out of the bushes, mm-hmm. versus sort of everyday spaces.
Can anyone take those classes, or do you need to be a student?
We're setting one up for the community. We haven't scheduled that yet, but so community members can take the class. So I just mm-hmm. teach it at UVA, but we would teach it in the community.
Great.
Lisa, what kind of verbal defense skills are involved with these with your self-defense programs?
So the way we approach self-defense is that it's on a continuum. So verbal self-defense is actually one of the techniques you also would be learning, all the way up to needing skills for physical confrontation. So we do different kinds of assertiveness skills. We teach a defensive yell with every single move. So there's a lot that the verbal techniques that are actually happening. And if you try verbal skills and that doesn't work and things escalate, you have things that can be in proportion to what's being inflicted upon you, is really that spectrum that we're looking at in the class.
So, go ahead, Nancy.
Okay. I know you had mentioned that sometimes on campus, I'm sure other places too, that assault is underreported. And that reminded me that some of what your self-defense is, your courses, involves the racialized gender, that black girls and black women have another layer of, another component to fight against, their own strong black woman response and all of the messages they have gotten. So I'm wondering, how do you incorporate a more individualized or one's identity, I guess, into your self-defense classes?
Yeah, so it's important to intersectionality as a concept and thinking of layers of different kinds of oppression that somebody may be experiencing has to, for me, really needs to be a part of that conversation. There's multiple identities, right, that each person may have that are they targeted because of their race? Are they targeted because of their gender identity? Are there two layers of things, three layers of things that are happening? So I would ask students to really think about the multiple ways in which they make sense of their identity and how self-defense could help out for lots of different ways in which violence may be inflicted. So a lot of the focus is on sexual assault, but there's lots of ways that somebody could be targeted that isn't specifically sexual assault, so that any of those skills could be helpful for multiple ways in which somebody may be targeted.
So I read on the Women's Center page, because a lot of your work you do in partnership with them, I believe, and you spoke last year, I believe it was pertaining to the Summer of Hate, the events of July and August 2017, and you were talking about self-defense, and I think one of the things, the theme was we need not think alike to love alike. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so that was at the Sexual Assault Resource Agency Breakfast Award ceremony, November 7th this year. Mm-hmm. And so part of what I felt like was happening after August 12th was there was a lot of division and sort of blame. If you're not radical enough, if you're not responding this way, then you're not with us, kind of division. And there's a lot of community members that are really trying to work together to create a better space in Charlottesville. And that piece is that we often don't think alike. And there isn't just one way to address these issues. And so I had kept saying that statement over and again, we need not think alike to love alike. And how can we, I've told a story of I'm very different from my police officer friend. We're probably only agree on two things, which is women have the right and ability to fight back. But that friendship has cultivated into this amazing curriculum, and learning from each other's, different perspectives has really helped both of us, I believe. So that was part of where that statement kept being made.
And the football coach as well, I think you mentioned, who you find that you have differences with, but...
Well, yeah, his players. I've had over 25 players in the last year in my classes, and had 11 in one of my classes this summer. And I just wanted to acknowledge, what within the athletic space, what there's been some great steps towards authenticity and just character. And so it's been really great to have them be involved in these gender studies classes, which is stereotypically not a space for football players.
Yeah, that's great.
Are there some commonalities, because you obviously see all sorts of women in your classes, and are there some commonalities between how women see themselves?
Yeah, there are some commonalities. I think that it really depends on each person's upbringing. There's definitely some cultural differences around that, but the fear that they've been socialized to fear being hurt is definitely a commonality, and feeling afraid to use their voices, or feeling like they don't have a voice, that they need to not make waves, sort of that's the stereotypical feminine expectations. Then you've got folks that were like, actually, my parents told me to kick the person in the groin if they got near me. So there's a little bit of a range that seems to be shifting. People are getting, I think women are gaining more of a voice in the last 25 years that I've seen, but there's still a lot of pressure to not make waves, to if they feel like if they speak up that they're somehow not going to be liked anymore. And so I definitely still see that happening.
And then I guess I know we're running out of time, but I did want to find out what you are currently working on, Lisa. What is going on with you?
Since I've been teaching human sexualities, I mean, human sexuality, healthy masculinity, all these things that we've been talking about today are ways in which we can actually have cultural change. And I feel like teaching human sexualities, my students were writing these amazing pieces. And so with a former student, Micah Jones, we're working on an anthology of the unheard voices, what is it called?
Oh.
The Unheard Voices of Navigating a Sexually Confusing Culture.
That's it.
And for a lot of folks, they are survivors of sexual violence themselves, but there's 36 people contributing pieces, and mainstream sex education has a lot of problems. But one of those problems is isolating folks and not enabling them to see their reality represented in the discussion of sex and sexuality. So we're trying to have this be a complimentary book to that discussion.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here, Lisa Spidell. I know you work closely with Sarah, so I want to shout out to the Sexual Assault Resource Agency. They do great work. And the Women's Center also, I know, does great work here, too.
Yes.
And thank you to you, specifically.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. It was fascinating. I really do want to talk more with you about what you had called the sexually confusing culture. So if we haven't touched on that already, maybe you'll come back.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. It's always awkward when I put people on the spot, isn't it? Like, but anyway. So, Nancy, do you have a news of note? It's time for that.
Alan, I do have a news of note. It's an old one, but it bears repeating because it's kind of back in the news. Five times more migrant children are in federal custody this summer than last summer. And, of course, that is straining the system and forever traumatizing the children in it. There are like 13,000 kids in prison in the U.S. right now. And as you probably heard this week, that it was just discovered that the White House took $10 million from FEMA and $29 million from the Coast Guard and $34 million from TSA and other programs, cybersecurity, because you know how they feel about that. And they moved this all over to their, what I'm calling their ethnic cleansing policy. All total, that's like $200 million from all over the Department of Homeland Security to ICE. That's $93 million for caging more kids and $107 million for their transportation and removal, as if they're hauling sanitation. I mean, that's what it sounds like. Funding for their imprisonment and their deportation has increased 29%. That's $3.6 billion. And at present, there are 100 prisons across the country, and they are going to expand that, triple the size.
I heard
that's what I got.
I'm glad you brought it up because it was so hard to hear all that about the money. But one victory, I will say, the ACLU had on that topic was that recently, this week, I believe, ACLU won a case for those families or parents who have been deported already, saying that those parents can return to the U.S. to ask for protection and be reunited with their kids, which apparently is a huge, huge deal. They hadn't originally gotten fair proceedings, no surprise there, because they were so traumatized. So that is... supposedly a very big break in that thing. I had one other thing I just wanted to mention because we need to vote, right? This is a huge thing that so I just wanted to mention that in Concord, New Hampshire, a 27-year-old pregnant woman, a refugee from Afghanistan, beat a lifelong Concord, New Hampshire resident in the Democratic primary election there this week. Safia Wazir beat Dick Patton, who had said her lack of experience and status as a refugee would hurt her campaign. So women continue to run and to win. So a little bit of good news there.
Yep, that is very good news.
Yes.
I'm glad I asked what you got. That's very good.
Yeah, thanks. So speaking of justice, as we were, our next guest is Cale Jaffe. We welcome him back. He's an environmental and regulatory law expert. He's the director of the Environmental and Regulatory Law Clinic at the University of Virginia School of Law. He has litigated before the Supreme Court of Virginia and in numerous energy-related cases before the Virginia State Corporation Commission. He's here specifically to talk about a Virginia mining case that would overturn a ban on uranium mining in Virginia and what the results would be on our health and environment if that were to occur and the implications for the rest of the country. So welcome back, Cale.
Thank you all very much for having me back.
Yes, it's a pleasure. So tell us about this case. It's called Virginia Uranium versus John Warren.
Right. So, and John Warren is the head of the Virginia Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy. So that's why his name is there. But it's essentially it's the mining company, Virginia Uranium, bringing a lawsuit against the Commonwealth of Virginia. So the case actually begins more than 30 years ago, back in 1982, when Virginia enacted a state law that imposed a moratorium that remains in place today to prohibit uranium mining in the Commonwealth of Virginia for a variety of reasons. And that moratorium was put on the books back in 1982. At the time, there was a lot of excitement about potential nuclear energy development. Then there was a series of events, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and the market for uranium fuel, for nuclear fuel, really collapsed. And the issue sort of lay dormant for many years until about 2007, when the price of uranium started to climb and the mining company decided they wanted to come back to Virginia. They pushed to try to convince Virginia's General Assembly to repeal that moratorium. The General Assembly, Republicans and Democrats together, said no, we want to keep the law the way it is. And the mining company has now brought a lawsuit that is going all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States to say that Virginia's law should be struck down as preempted by federal law, and particularly by the Federal Atomic Energy Act.
So I'm just going to interrupt you. I'm sorry. You took a breath and I went for it. We need to take a hard break. We're going to be right back because we really want to discuss this case that's going to affect everybody in Virginia. So we'll be right back. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We'll be back with Cale Jaffe right after this. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something, and we're talking with Cale Jaffe. I interrupted you, but I believe we were talking about the Atomic Energy Act and the specifics about Virginia uranium against the Commonwealth of Virginia. So if you want to continue.
Sure. And so essentially what this the mining industry has argued is that the Federal Atomic Energy Act, which gives the Nuclear Regulatory Commission authority to over how to process nuclear fuel, they want to extend that to say that also preempts Virginia's prohibition on mining. And what's really sort of fascinating about the case is that you're used to hearing traditional conservatives talk about states' rights. And so whenever the federal government seeks to impose, let's say, an environmentally protective regime, for example, you know, recently the Obama administration's former Clean Power Plan on global warming. Whenever you saw the federal government try to do something environmentally protective, industry, mining industry, the coal mining industry certainly would say, oh, this is an intrusion on states' rights. This is an overreach by the federal government. And here now we have a state choosing to say, you know, we don't think this is the right path for us. We want to prohibit mining in the state and develop agriculture and tourism and beautiful river that we've got in Southern Virginia. And now those same voices that had said states' rights are now saying, oh, no, the federal interest has to dominate. The state law has to be preempted, essentially because we don't like where it's leading us.
Mm-hmm. It couldn't have anything to do with, like, the cash involved with that uranium that they want to mine in Virginia, right? I'm sure that has nothing to do with wanting to take back states' rights, right?
It's the you know, the financing of the project is, that issue is really fascinating because the mining company has said, oh, this deposit might be worth $5 billion or $6 billion. They talk about all this economic value there, but there's not a suggestion that that economic value would actually stay in the community. And what's really fascinating is the local chambers of commerce, the civic and business leaders in the Southern Virginia community have actually said, no, we want to keep the ban on uranium mining because we know that the money won't stay in our community. The money would get exported out and it would be to the detriment. It would impoverish our community, not enrich it. They you know, there was a civic leader that we actually, it was quoted in a newspaper article, and we referenced it in our brief with the Supreme Court of the United States on this, where he said, I see a beautiful river, I can see shops and technology companies, all of those things fit together. I don't see a mine. And that's really sort of the story here. There isn't, this isn't about sort of the economy versus the environment. This is about two competing visions for economic development for Southern Virginia. One that would be very extractive and would impoverish the local communities, and one that would diversify and stabilize the economy with tourism, with agriculture and the like.
Well, what are the impacts that you would see, the negative impacts of doing that on the environment?
So one of the big, separate out the environmental impacts and the economic impacts. They're interrelated to a large degree, but they're distinct impacts. So first, on the economic impacts, what is amazing about the uranium market is it has really historically been a boom and bust industry. When the price of nuclear fuel is very high, mines open and are extremely active, and then the price can drop often for decades at a time, and then those mines are just absolutely shuttered. So, you know, you had huge price spikes for nuclear fuel back in the 70s, and then a huge drop in nuclear fuel prices in the early 80s, and it stayed remarkably low until about 2000, and then went up with the market in the early 2000s, and then crashed again, and has stayed very low. So that boom and bust economy might be fine for the individual publicly traded corporation, but for the communities there in Southern Virginia, for the mining families, for the farming families next door, that kind of boom and bust economy can be disastrous.
So it's extremely volatile.
Absolutely.
Industry. And then you were going to talk about
down there too, right? That sort of are based on like settled law, have moved in there and have a whole social system involved, you know, of their own, just assuming that their backyard wasn't going to get turned into a mining.
Right. Yeah. There are two. Nancy, that's a good point. There are two private schools down there. There's Chatham Hall School. It's an all-girls boarding school, and Hargrave Military Academy. And those two schools are, you know, less than a 10-mile drive from where this uranium mine would be. They're trying to attract families to send their kids to Southern Virginia to go to these schools. And part of the attraction, of course, is that this is a safe and beautiful environment. I talked, and this was several years ago now, but to somebody who was in business development at Halifax Regional Hospital, the hospital just down river from where the mine would be. And he would say, you know, I've got to attract medical professionals to live in this community. And how I attract them is to say, this is a beautiful community. It's a beautiful river. It's a great place to raise a family. If we're next door to this massive uranium mining project, those medical professionals that have a choice about where they live, they're going to pick up their families and move. And it's the marginalized members of those communities who don't have a choice, who don't have that same kind of economic mobility, that will be left in a more impoverished community.
And how will this affect other states that aren't involved in this case?
You know, what's really been fascinating is that a lot of other states from across the political spectrum have weighed in support of Virginia, in support of Virginia's right to ban uranium mining. So the state of Texas, the state of Indiana, the state of Washington, among several others, have actually filed a brief now in the Supreme Court of the United States to say, hey, you know, Virginia is making a choice about how to protect its environment, but also about how to develop its economy. And we can't let this uranium mining industry run roughshod over that.
Mm-hmm. So has the Atomic Energy Act,
That's right, yeah.
Okay, has it ever been, is this the first time it's been like turned on its head and used against itself to like push the state's rights away and for the federal government to barge in and tell, you know, and tell the state what to do?
Well, there are a handful of other cases that have brought in this issue, and that the briefs before the Supreme Court I'll discuss. One is this case called the Pacific Gas case out of California, where the California legislature had enacted a law. They were concerned about nuclear power construction and what's going to happen to the spent nuclear fuel. And so they actually imposed a moratorium on any nuclear power construction for our new nuclear power plants, saying until the federal government figures out what it's going to do with this nuclear waste, until we're sure that it's going to be safe, we're banning new nuclear power plants. The same challenge was brought there, saying that's in conflict with the Federal Atomic Energy Act. And the Supreme Court ruled, actually, no, that California has its legitimate reasons, its economic reasons for choosing to put a ban on nuclear power construction. That's entirely within the state's purview, and upheld that law. I think I don't remember the exact year. I could look it up, but I think it's in the early 80s was that case. Mm-hmm.
So how do you describe their position? What basis do they have?
It's really what basis does the mining company had?
No, that the act would preempt the law.
So the gist of the argument is that the Federal Atomic Energy Act sort of divides the development of nuclear fuel into two parts. It says there's the mining piece, and it says the states have exclusive control over the mining of the uranium ore. And then it says that the federal government, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, has exclusive control over the processing of that ore into nuclear fuel. And what the mining company has said is Virginia, by banning the mining, over which they have control, that they've prevented the ore from getting to the NRC-regulated activities, getting to the federal government for processing. And so that's the gist of it, that essentially that Virginia's ban is in conflict with the development of nuclear fuel mm-hmm. under the Federal Atomic Energy Act. That would be a really remarkable, reach of expansion of federal law that would be unprecedented.
So they're just grasping to find a way.
It's hard for me to see how the court does not defer to the state's authority to sort of develop the economy the way it has mm-hmm. chosen to do so. And, you know, in Alan, you hinted at this earlier, and I wanted to get back to it, the environmental impacts. I mean, those are inextricably intertwined with the economic impacts, but the environmental impacts of mining as mining, take aside the milling and processing of nuclear fuel, you have this massive open pit mine, hundreds of millions of pounds of ore that you're trying to mine out of the ground. That massive project is going to have environmental impacts in terms of water quality impacts, water shortage impacts. There's a major problem with an issue called acid mine drainage, where water running off of a mine site pollutes the nearby streams and rivers. So there are significant, you're talking about a massive industrial project. It's obviously going to have environmental impacts on the immediate region.
Right, it sounds like a worse, it's worse enough. It sounds like another Flint is what it sounds like, in it for the money and the residents be damned or something, instead of, something like, do they have any argument on the other side, like wind and solar power or technologies like that promise no harm, less harm, no harm to the environment are where we'd like to direct our attention, not this uranium?
Right. I think the larger point is there are a lot of ways that Southern Virginia, sort of the area where this mine would be, can choose to develop their economy, to develop the industries that they want to see in the community. And for an entity that's, publicly traded on the on a Canadian stock exchange as a mining company to sort of come in and run roughshod over what the local chambers of commerce, what the local elected officials have said that they want to do. What's interesting about this is it isn't a neatly a sort of a left versus right political issue. There are a lot of very conservative voices in Southern Virginia, Republicans in Southern Virginia, who are on the side of the Commonwealth of Virginia and saying, no, the moratorium, the ban on uranium mining is justified. It's what we need to protect our community, and we're sticking with it.
So as
Congress as well, right? Sorry, on Congress as well is gives states the power to decide whether they want nuclear power.
Yeah, absolutely. The Federal Atomic Energy Act makes it explicit that the states get to control the mining side of this process. And the uranium mining company might not like what Virginia decided, but it's clear that that's Virginia's choice to make.
I just wanted, as we wrap up, we have a little time left, not that much. I wanted to know what your role is, how you got involved, and also just anything that you would want to say as your parting words.
Sure. So I got involved in working on this case back before I went to the law school at the University of Virginia. I was at the Southern Environmental Law Center. The Southern Environmental Law Center is still very involved in the case, working with groups like the Roanoke River Basin Association and the Dan River Basin Association. I remained involved working with actually some of the local economic development groups, the local chambers of commerce and civic and trade and economic development associations that we've represented, that the UVA Clinic has represented, actually working with a law firm, Eckert Siemens, that we've brought an amicus brief to share that story with the Supreme Court.
That's great. And is there anything that you want to leave us with, or you feel like we've...
You think you're going to win?
Yes.
Gonna win?
Good question.
What do you think?
You know, I'm a firm believer in that lawyers should never sort of guess at how the outcome of a case is going to come out. Just sort of put their best argument out there and leave it to the justices or the judges to decide.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Kale Jaffe, Director of the Environmental and Regulatory Law Clinic at the University of Virginia School of Law.
Thank you all.
November 5th, right? Is that right?
The argument is on November 5th, and then decision probably in the spring or...
Oh, man.
Are there things we can do, you know, put comments somewhere or call?
You know, not so much at this point. I mean, if it comes back to the political process, certainly remain engaged. But right now, it's just in front of the court.
Okay. Thank you again.
Thanks.
Yep.
Nancy.
I think I know.
It's time for the palate cleanser.
Yes. Wash away that uranium.
How about if you go first?
Yeah, you okay?
Yeah.
All right. Mine is in New York City. The public library is opening its closet, not its bookshelves, its closet, to anyone who needs to borrow job interview accessories like ties and briefcases and business-like handbags for anyone, like for a three-week period. It's like an initiative that was launched because so many students were coming in taking advantage of their free career resources. They decided to extend their career resources to these sorts of job interview accessories. And they also can get access to interviewing tips and professional fashion advice for career-looking attire. Anyway, all you need is your library card, and you can check these things out.
That's so cool.
I know. What do you got?
I'm just wondering how this is something that you would say, like, how long will it be before this administration makes you show like 12 forms of ID before you can do any of that? So what I have is the following. Did you know that anyone could submit ideas to get an emoji put on phones and other media?
I did not know that.
They have a very strict approval process, but you can go to unicode.org/emoji. And there's a ton of regulations and stuff, but it's really interesting. There are things like, one of the things that says that you need to do is break new ground. You know, it has to be easily represented.
You have to break new ground.
Yeah, that, in quotes.
You need to be a vanguard on the emoji landscape.
But like one case was not regarding that, but apparently, maybe you're familiar with the paella emoji, you know, that Spanish dish made of usually...
I didn't know it had an emoji, so no, I'm not familiar.
Yeah, well, it caused outrage in Spain because it was represented... It was developed by, I believe, a British and an American person, and it had all kinds of things in there that was not really what should go in a paella. So they were just... There was, like, campaigns against it, so it caused Unicode to change it. And so now I think it's only showing seafood or whatever's appropriate. But my question to you is, what emoji would you submit if you could submit one? And if you don't have it now, you could tell us later. But can I tell you what mine is?
I have a guess about yours, but I would love to hear the actual answer. Yes.
I don't know if you can guess. But
I'm going to say it's got... Oh, I'm not going to guess. Yeah, you go.
Well, you please, can, but please. I would submit... This is a political answer. I have a political answer and a food answer. But the political answer is a Mueller emoji, where he's wearing a cape made of rainbows and unicorns, squashing an orange Cheeto, Holding a Scale of Justice.
I've seen that. No, I'm kidding. Okay.
Yeah, so that's so sappy. But anyway, I just thought that was really interesting. There's probably a lot of interesting cases about emojis that we could refer to.
What's your food one?
Oh, I don't really have that now, but to be determined.
Oh, that was the one I had for you.
It's
so simple. I'm sure you'd never go for it now, but I thought you'd just say persimmon.
Oh.
The persimmon emoji. I know,
yeah.
It's way too under. It's not complex enough for you.
But you know what? It's in season right now. Well, it's coming up in season. I'm very excited about persimmons. It always comes back to food. So our theme music is by Springtide, and I wanted to say that, remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. We have another minute or so, Nance, if you want to chime in.
I do want to say something myself. I want to say to all listeners to follow us on AOS Radio on Twitter and AOS Radio on Facebook. And here's why we want you to follow, not just to follow us, because we have homework. I want to know, leave us a comment. If he weren't in prison, what costly item would be on Manafort's dry cleaning bill this week? Give us his most outrageous garment or rug or whatever it is. Go nuts. Let us know what would he be dropping off at his dry cleaners if, of course, he wasn't in prison.
Yeah.
That's it. AOS Radio.
Yes. I'm going to put you on the spot and say, and it's okay if you don't know, but I don't. I don't recall who's on next week. Do you know?
Ooh. Yes. Jay King. And, I'm going to mispronounce this person's name, and that'll be embarrassing. It's someone you know. Aaron?
Aaron Shetterling.
There you go.
Shetterly,
that's
the
one.
Yes. So, we'll tell you more about that next week or maybe on social media. But
Aaron Shetterly, there it is. Yep, I'm staring at it.
I'm drawing this out because we have a little time to play with. But thanks, everyone, for being here. Lisa Spidell, Cale Jaffe. Thanks, Nance, especially to you.
Oh, thank you.
See you next week.
Hey.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and hosts Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.